you know, and the SES is the top of the totem pole in the federal government. And anybody, I guess, who's a lifer, who really wants to get ahead and who wants to make a difference is looking at the SES. When you get into grades 13, 14, and 15, you've made the cut. You know, you're the next step is possible training for the SES. And the Senior Executive Association did a study recently, a survey, which I think you guys talked about last week on your show. And they surveyed a large number of people. It was 10,000 or more. You know, most surveys are less than 1,000 people, but this was tens of thousands of people. SES are people in the grades 13, 14, 15 range. And what they found was that a lot of these people are not anxious to move up. They see no incentive for it. The hours are terrible. Weekend work is the norm, and they don't get locality pay raises and a variety of things. And she said the thing that the survey showed them is that a lot of people who should be moving up, who the country needs to move into these jobs, fill these SES positions, are just not interested. And I think about half of the SES is eligible to retire tomorrow if they wanted to. You know, these are senior, longtime people. So it'll be interesting to get their perspective and see if anybody calls in and says, are you kidding? For that money, I'll take it in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. In fact, when we talked about, as you said, we talked about that survey on the Daily Debrief last week, and I got some responses in email and in tweets, people saying, that's exactly why I'm not in government service anymore. The payoff is just not worth the investment. We put in the hours and the weekends and everything else. On the other hand, it's like you said, it depends on not just your devotion to the government service, but the size of the paycheck.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, when we talked with her before, Carol Bonacero before, she had indicated that she was worried about the future of SES. Do you think this survey backs that up?
The results would back that up. I mean, I'm always interested when people, and maybe I'm too self-serving, but when people talk about the future of the organization and whatnot, my feeling is most of us, the future of the organization ends with us.
You know,
that said, they're professionals. They're in the business of taking care of not only their members, but their future members. And they obviously want the best, and from this survey, I think they've drawn the conclusion that something's got to be done. Is it better pay? Is it locality pay? And that's an interesting point, too, that SES members do not get locality pay.
Wonder why? So,
well, it's the way Congress wrote it. The idea was it's all based on merit within a certain pay spread. But if you, for instance, if you are an SESer who works in Huntsville, Alabama, you get the same salary if they transfer you to San Francisco, you know, one of the highest cost areas in the country. So that's a very strange thing to have. And also, I think the survey showed that a number of people in like grades 14 and 15 at the top are actually making more than their SES bosses because of this sort of artificial cap. So it's a very tricky situation. And, you know, it's hard to bleed for people making six-figure salaries, whatever they do. But that said, these are really important jobs. And if you go to the SEA's banquet, which they have every year at the State Department, and you see the award winners, the Presidential Merit Award winners, and you see what they've accomplished, and this is not just numbers and paper shuffling. This is million-dollar programs, billion-dollar programs, you know, putting people on the moon and that sort of thing. When you look at these jobs, it's the kind of thing a lot of Americans would like to have these jobs. Not many Americans could do these jobs.
Can I get a little philosophical and ethereal with you on this? Tell me and our audience a bit about why the SESers are so important. I mean, you just illustrated that a lot of Americans might want the jobs but couldn't do the jobs. What is it about the organization itself that makes it so critical to the tapestry?
It's a great question. There are relatively few political appointees in the government, maybe a couple of thousand. So President Obama comes in, he's got a couple of thousand jobs at most that he can put people at Interior and Justice and what have you. And they are the political bosses, and they're supposed to carry out the bidding of the White House. And to some extent, Congress. The SES people are there. They were there before you, the political appointee, arrived. They will probably be there after you leave. And they are the continuity. And these are the people that you go to. And as you know, so many of these political jobs they put a caretaker in. They put somebody in who wants to run for office later on, or who wants to be on, remain on the government payroll, some government payroll, or they're waiting until an opening occurs in their home state, and then they'll go back and run for the House or the Senate. But so a lot of these people, they're bright, they're smart, everything, but they may not know anything about the program, you know, anything at all. I mean, just they just put them there because it's there and it's convenient. And I could name dozens of things, and I'm sure most federal workers could name hundreds of people like that. But that said, they're the boss. And so when they come in, they've got their political appointees who are often there for the same reasons. It's a favoritism job. You know, they're being paid off. They were loyal, working for the party in power. Whatever reason they want to be in the government. And according to the Brookings Institution, those political appointees last about 18 months. That's the average lifespan.
Not long.
It's long enough to mess up some things. It's long enough to ruin some people's careers, but it's not a lifetime of work. So they depend on these career bureaucrats, if you will, these senior executive people who've mostly come up from the ranks. And these are the people that know how the programs work. And they will, the secretary will say, I think tomorrow we'll sell Utah to, Canada. And somebody will come in from the Interior Department and say, sir, that's not really a good idea because, you know, and that's really what they do is they're the institutional memory and the common sense and the true North compass, you know.
And this is what you'll be talking about tomorrow.
Yes.
On your turn with Carol.
Absolutely. Carol Bonacero.
She's the whole hour?
No, we're going to have some financial planning advice as well.
Oh, tell me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, the conventional wisdom is that the stock market does well up through May. And then in May, it sort of goes into the doldrums for the summer. And a lot of people who watch the market have said, I think this has happened 23 out of the last 24 years and whatnot. So they're thinking about, is this a good time if you're heavily into stocks, as in the thrift savings plan, and the C and the S and the I funds are all doing very, very, very well. They've doubled since March of a year ago. But is this a time to rebalance your portfolio? Is it a time to sell? And we're going to be looking at that. And of course, nobody knows, but we give you some common sense tips.